without a spring or an itch. Pain that swelling or twitch, call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky, I call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. So what does a drumbeat have to do with medicine? Absolutely nothing. I could have said that this was a segue into a discussion on the heart and the heartbeat, but I'm not going to fool with you. It's just one of my favorite repetitive drumbeats, and it's been one that's been used in hundreds, if not thousands, of songs, even in today's music genre. It's called the Amen Break, and it comes from the B-side of a 1969 track by the soul group, The Winstons. Think about an experience that makes you feel good. It could be successfully completing a project at work, eating a warm chocolate chip cookie, or taking a swig of whiskey. It could be a puff of a cigarette, or a shopping trip, or maybe a hit of heroin.
It's difficult to explain how drug addiction develops over time. Why do they do it? This is a question that friends and families often ask of those who are addicted.
To many, it looks like the constant search for pleasure. But the pleasure derived from opioids like heroin or stimulants like cocaine declines with repeated use.
What's more, some addictive drugs like nicotine fail to produce any noticeable euphoria in regular users. Now, these experiences don't automatically lead to addiction. So the question becomes, what makes a particular habit or substance become an addiction?
Why do some people, and not just people, in fact, animals, also become addicted and seek out these experiences, even if they are costly or detrimental to their health and well-being? Before starting this topic, let's begin by exposing some of the myths concerning addiction. There are two popular mythical explanations for addiction.
The first is that compulsive drug taking is simply a bad habit. In other words, a habit that just simply needs to be kicked. But to the brain, it is simply not that simple.
You know, a habit is nothing more than our ability to carry out repetitive tasks, such as tying our shoelaces or brushing our teeth. Over time, doing it more and more efficiently. We don't often see people getting caught up in an endless and compulsive cycle of shoelace tying. Our second myth is that overcoming withdrawal is just too tough for many addicts.
We mentioned the term withdrawal, so we really have to define this word in the context of the addict. Withdrawal is a highly unpleasant feeling that occurs when the drug leaves your body. The symptoms of withdrawal can include sweat, chills, anxiety, and heart palpitation.
And for certain drugs, such as alcohol, withdrawal comes with a risk of death if not properly managed. The painful symptoms of withdrawal, some of which we've already mentioned, are frequently cited as the reason addiction seems inescapable.
However, even for heroin, withdrawal symptoms mostly subside after about 2 weeks. Plus, many addictive drugs produce varying and sometimes only mild withdrawal symptoms.
Now, this is not to say that pleasure, habits, or withdrawal are not involved in addiction, but we must ask whether they are necessary components of addiction or whether addiction would persist even in their absence.
According to Maureen Boyle, director of science at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, addiction itself is a biopsychosocial disorder. It's a combination of your genetics, your neurobiology, and how that interacts with psychological and social factors.
That means it's a lot like any other chronic disorder, such as type 2 diabetes, cancer, or even heart disease. But addiction is both preventable and treatable. However, if it is left untreated, addiction can last a lifetime.
There are many types of addiction and many different people who are addicted But what's common across all substances and behavioral addiction is their amazing ability to increase levels of an important chemical in the brain called dopamine.
We have mentioned dopamine on many radio shows since it's involved in just so many of the body's processes. Dopamine is a molecule that ferries messages across the brain's reward center. It's what gives people the feeling of pleasure, and it reinforces behaviors that are critical for survival, such as eating food and having sex.
When someone uses a drug or engages in pleasurable experience, the same natural reward circuitry is activated. The problem with drugs is that they do the job better than natural rewards. Different drugs tap into the dopamine reward system in different ways.
There are differences in how the dopamine and pleasure systems are involved depending on which drugs are used. Heroin, for example, has a chemical structure that's similar to another neurotransmitter and can actually trick some brain cells into activating neurons that use dopamine.
On the other hand, cocaine and amphetamine prolong the effects of dopamine on its target nerve and therefore disrupt normal communication in the brain.
In the 1980s, researchers made a surprising discovery. Food, sex, and drugs all appeared to cause dopamine to be released in certain areas of the brain, such as a portion called the nucleus accumbens.
This suggested to many in the scientific community that these areas were the brain's pleasure centers and that dopamine was our own internal pleasure neurotransmitter. However, the idea has since been debunked.
The brain does have pleasure centers, but they're not modulated by dopamine. So what's going on? Well, it turns out that in the brain, liking something and wanting something are really two separate psychological experiences. Liking refers to the spontaneous delight one might experience, for example, eating a chocolate chip cookie, while wanting is our grumbling desire when we eye the plate of cookies in the center of the table during a meeting. Dopamine is responsible for the wanting, not for the liking.
For example, in one study, researchers observed rats that could not produce dopamine in their brains lost the urge to eat but still had pleasurable facial reaction when food was placed in their mouths.
All drugs of abuse trigger a surge of dopamine, a rush of wanting in the brain, and this makes us crave more drugs. So with repeated drug use, the wanting grows while our liking of the drug appears to stagnate or even decrease. A phenomenon that is now known as tolerance. The question may be, how active in this regard are different chemicals? This often depends on how quickly each drug can get into the brain and how powerfully it activates the neural circuits.
Some modes of use, like injecting or snorting a drug, make the drug's effects almost immediate. As individuals continue with addictive habits or substances, the brain adapts. It tries to reestablish a balance between the dopamine surges and normal levels of the substance in the brain.
How is this done? The nerves begin to produce less dopamine or simply reduce the number of dopamine receptors. What this results in is that the individual needs to continue to use drugs or practice a particular behavior to bring dopamine levels back to normal.
Individuals may also need to take great amounts of drugs to achieve a high. This is the definition of tolerance. It simply means needing to take an increased amount of a substance to get the same effect.
There's a cascade effect when dopamine is decreased. As the feelings of pleasure are created in the brain, individuals also become more sensitive to negative emotions, such as stress, anxiety, and depression. And sometimes, people with addiction may actually feel physically ill. To get rid of this feeling of illness, the user then wishes to obtain drugs again, simply to relieve these symptoms of withdrawal.
Believe it or not, eventually the desire for the drug becomes more important than the actual pleasure it provides. Remember that we said that dopamine has multiple uses in the human body.
Thus, dopamine plays a key role in learning and memory, so it eventually hardwires the need for the addictive substance or experience into the brain, along with any environmental cues associated with it, such as people, places, things, and situations associated with past use.
Take alcohol, for example. Memories become so entwined that even walking into a bar years later or talking to the same friends an individual had previously binged with may then trigger an alcoholic's craving.
Brain imaging studies done on people with addiction reveal other striking changes as well. For example, people with alcohol, cocaine, or opioid use disorders show a loss in neurons and impaired activity in their prefrontal cortex of the brain. What this does is it erodes their ability to make sound decisions and regulate their impulses. Some people are more susceptible to these extreme neurobiological changes than others, and therefore more susceptible to addiction.
Not everyone who tries a cigarette or gets morphine after a surgery becomes addicted to drugs. Similarly, not everyone who gambles becomes addicted to gambling. Many factors influence the development of addiction.
One of the biggest risk factors is actually age. The younger someone is, the more vulnerable they are to addiction. In one federal study from 2014, it was discovered that the majority, actually almost 75% of 18 to 30-year-olds admitted to treatment programs had started using drugs at age 17 or younger.
Additionally, like most behavioral and mental health disorders, there are many genes that add to a person's level of risk or provide some protection against addiction.
But unlike the way in which doctors can predict a person's risk of breast cancer by looking for mutations in a certain gene, nobody knows enough to be able to single out any gene or predict the likelihood of inheriting traits that could lead to addiction. We have not touched on pleasure versus desire, though, in our discussion today, so you may think that they're one and the same, but they're not.
There is a small subregion of the amygdala in the brain that is best known for its role in fear and emotion. By activating this area in rats, they were more likely to show addictive-like behaviors, narrowing their focus, rapidly escalating their cocaine intake, and even compulsively nibbling at a cocaine port.
So this subregion may be involved in excessive wanting in humans also, influencing us to make risky choices. As with any of these addicting drugs, the users tend to develop tolerance. The drug becomes less and less effective, and they need larger doses of the drug to control, for example, pain.
What happens here is that this exposes people to large surges of dopamine in the brain. The result of this regular intake of large amounts of drug is the hyperactive wanting system, which we touched on previously.
So with increased use of the drugs over time, a sensitized wanting system triggers intense bouts of craving whenever in the presence of the drug or exposed to drug cues. Now, what are these cues? Well, they could include drug paraphernalia, negative emotions such as stress, or even specific people and places. Drug cues are one of the addict's biggest challenges.
These changes in the brain can be long-lasting, if not permanent. Early life stressors such as childhood adversity or physical abuse also seem to put people at more risk.
Many people regularly indulge in drugs of abuse such as alcohol or nicotine. We may even occasionally overindulge. Luckily, in most cases, this doesn't qualify as addiction.
This is in part because we manage to regain balance and choose alternative rewards like spending time with family or enjoyable drug-free hobbies. However, for those susceptible to excessive wanting, it may be difficult to maintain that balance.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. You've heard the saying such as, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. How about, it's better to find a whole worm in your apple than half a worm. And finally, if life gives you lemons, make apple juice and make people wonder how the hell you did it. Our question for today is, are apple bacteria good or bad? Well, apparently it depends on the apple.
All apples have millions of bacteria, but unfortunately, not all of these bacterial populations are equally helpful.
In 2018, the United States alone produced approximately 5.13 million tons of apples.
And in 2015, a study found that 18.9% of a child's total fruit intake consisted of apples. This much loved fruit is an excellent source of nutrients containing vitamin C, multiple B complex, vitamins, natural antioxidants, and numerous minerals. Apples are also a good source of dietary fiber.
However, as with any other raw food, apples are also a source of microorganisms that enter the gut and colonize it. A study was done to find out whether there was a difference between the bacterial populations carried by organic, hand-grown apples and those present in typical store-bought apples, which have often had more exposure to chemical fertilizers and pesticides.
We are not just talking about the microorganisms that are on the outside of the apple. The bacteria, fungi, and viruses in our food transiently colonize our gut. Cooking kills most of these. So raw fruit and vegetables are particularly important source of gut microbes.
These researchers didn't just analyze the apple as a whole, but analyzed the bacterial content of the different components of the apple, such as the stem, the peel, fruit, pulp, seeds, and the calyx. They did this for both organic apples and conventional store-bought apples. Then they compared their findings for these two types of fruit.
The team found that both types of apples harbored a similar number of bacteria. A typical apple contains roughly 100 million bacteria.
The team also found that most of the bacteria were present in the apple's seeds, and most of the remaining bacteria had settled in the pulp. There were clear differences between the bacterial populations present in organic versus regular store-bought apples.
Freshly harvested, organically managed apples harbor a significant, more diverse, more even, and distinct bacterial community compared to conventional ones. In regular store-bought apples, potentially harmful bacteria seem to be more abundant.
By contrast, organic apples appear to contain a more significant number of healthful bacteria. Escherichia shigella, a group of bacteria that includes known pathogens, was found in most of the conventional apple samples, but none from the organic apples. And the beneficial lactobacilli, you know, of probiotic fame, they were way more prevalent in the organic apples.
Methylobacterium, which is known to enhance the biosynthesis of strawberry flavor compounds, was significantly more abundant in organic apples, especially on peel and flesh samples.
So in a nutshell, the study seemed to suggest that researchers should repeat this analysis for other kinds of fruit to find out whether other dietary staples also differ in terms of their bacterial content based on cultivation methods. Let's get on to another food subject, and that's a study that showed that eating early in the day may actually help weight loss by curbing appetite.
So what happens if we shift our entire window of daily eating to a small period in the beginning of our day rather than dividing it throughout a 12-hour or more period.
The study did corroborate success in losing weight, and it appears that this is likely due to the fact that there is a appetite and hunger hormone reduction rather than just calorie burning.
The new research finds that eating only between 8 a.m. and 2 p.m. curbs the appetite. So the researchers wrote that eating in sync with circadian rhythms by eating early in the daytime appeared to reduce body weight and improve metabolic health.
What they did not know was why. So a new study was done and became the first randomized trial to determine how meal timing affects 24-hour energy metabolism when food intake and meal frequency are matched.
The researchers compared two groups of people who ate the same three meals per day for 4 days, but with different timing. The early time restricted feeding, we will call the ETRF group, and the other, the control group.
A total of 11 men and women completed the trial, 6 in the ETRF group and 5 in the control group. The ETRF group breakfasted at 8 a.m. and ate their last meal at 2 p.m. No dinner, no snacks. They literally fasted for around 18 hours before eating breakfast the next day.
The control group also breakfasted at 8 a.m., but their last meal of the day was 8 p.m. Therefore, they fasted for around 12 hours before breakfasting the next day. So maybe ancient survival mechanisms contribute to the obesity epidemic.
By stressing the cells in the same way as starvation, overeating can slow energy release from fat storage, according to the research that was initially done in mice.
Getting back to the human study, on the fourth day, the participants underwent a battery of tests in a respiratory chamber to measure their metabolism. The measures include calories burned and the amount of fat, carbohydrates, and proteins burned.
The participants rated various aspects of appetite, such as hunger, desire, and capacity to eat, as well as fullness.
From blood and urine samples that participants gave in the morning and evening, the team was also able to assess levels of hunger hormone. The results clearly showed that calorie burning did not differ much between the groups.
However, those on the ETRF schedule had lower levels of the hunger hormone, ghrelin, and reported improvement in some facets of appetite. The findings also revealed that the ETRF group appeared to have burned more fat over a 24-hour period. Possibly eating the last meal of the day in the afternoon could help the body switch from burning carbohydrates to burning fat for energy.
Unfortunately, findings from animal studies appear to conflict with those of human studies. Some rodent-based studies have suggested that meal timing strategies help shed weight through calorie burning, while others have not found this.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV, AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We've also set up a website for our Medical Marijuana Society at www.medmarsoc.com. That's www.medmarsoc.com. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com.
Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc Show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.